your work life, your relationships, your money, your health, the meaning of life. Welcome to How to Do Life with Marty Nemko.
Hi, I'm Marty Nemko. This is week 13 of my new show, How to Do Life. And, you know, shows are in 13-week segments. So I thought to kind of wrap this up, I would do a show that's kind of broad on the life well led. I'm going to talk about my very best ideas about work, about relationships, about money, about health, and about emotional health, starting with work. I want to start with a myth. The myth is that there is a well-suited career if you just work hard enough at finding it. And so people take all kinds of tests and they do all kinds of informational interviews and tryouts. The truth is, at least, you know, I've had 5,800 career counseling clients. Generally, only after a small amount of reflection and exploration, the choices end up being equal. Your success and happiness are not going to depend on which one of the careers, but whether you make the most of it, and luck, and how, you know, diligently you work to land a particular job. Basically, if you can just, I'm sure you can self-identify this, and self-identification is often more valid than tests, because tests just are these, they're distal from your lifetime of understanding of yourself. If you're self-assessing, you're considering everything. So just think about which one or two of these things are you. Are you really mainly a word person? Word in terms of explanation or word in terms of persuasion? Are you more of a people person? A people person in terms of getting along with people versus persuasion versus supervising? Are you more of a STEM person? Science, technology, engineering, and math person? And that, of course, would include computers. Are you more of a social? Are you more of a entrepreneurial type who can come up with ideas? They don't have to be that innovative, but maybe it's a replicated idea that you put into a new circumstance, a new situation, or do cost effectively, or simply do a good job of creating that pizza shop in a great location. Are you somebody who's more hands-on, either at designing things or fixing things? Just simply self-evaluate those one or two things and then pick a career that utilizes those one or two things, maybe by either the things that the careers that come off the top of your head, or there are two resources that can help you in an hour screen hundreds of careers. One is the Occupational Outlook Handbook. It's free online. Just Google it. The other is my book, Careers for Dummies, which divides careers into those categories I just mentioned. Simply scanning those, which has a little paragraph description about each, is a pretty darn good way to pick. And then if you want to do a little more, fine, do a little Google searching. But this false precision sitting on the sidelines waiting for the magic career to hit you like manna from heaven is not a great idea. The other work-related tip that I want to stress is that people are lemmings. If they, you know, you're told follow your passion, do what you love, and the money will follow. Problem with that is that too many people love the same one of the same few things: entertainment, environment, sports, fashion, broadcasting, politics. So the odds of succeeding and getting a decent job that pays well and is reasonably stable in those fields is really tough unless you're a superstar and or very well connected. So try to go under the radar. Try to, you know, do your passions as a hobby, but not so much as a career unless you're super talented, super connected, and super driven. But I don't want to imply that you shouldn't be trying to make a difference. But a difference can be defined in liberal terms and conservative terms. In liberal terms, of course, it's working to, quote, save the planet. It could be to help minorities. It could be to help the poor, redistribute more to the poor. But there's conservative ways to make a difference, too. If you believe the best ideas are those that are brought to market for the public, where whether it's a new iPhone or a new toilet paper that's cheaper or better and doesn't break at the moment of truth, that's making a big difference, too, as long as you're being ethical. And the last thing I want to say is, because it's so difficult to land a good job, it's wise to not ignore the job that, quote, falls in your lap. Jobs generally don't fall in your lap at random. Generally, somebody touts you, or you're otherwise well-suited, or they wouldn't just give you, drop it in your lap. So realizing that your success and contentment in a job is going to depend much more on whether you make the most of it than on which career, given the difficulty of landing a good job, seriously consider that job that drops in your lap. And often, by the way, one of the reasons a job drops in your lap is because a family member or a lover or whatever touts you for it. And well, if that, let's say your father or mother is in that career, in addition to that being easier to get that job, that person is going to give you inside information on how to succeed in the career you can't get from the outside. So that's the last thing I want to say in terms of the life well led regarding work. Now let's turn to relationships. The most important thing I can say is high standards. Better solo than so-so. In other words, better to be alone than in a so-so relationship. And many people find themselves happiest when they are alone. You can get up when you want. You can start work when you want. Nobody's pressuring you to spend more or less, or let alone get high with the person. You can eat what you want when you want. You can sleep in the room at the temperature you want. If you want conversation, you can find somebody to converse with. But if you are living together, it's compromise land. So sure, if you have a marriage made in heaven, or at least one that really works well on earth, or any kind of relationship, and of course I'm talking about straight and gay, you know, everybody, really hold the highest standards. And what the highest standards are those that where your partner, potential partner, scores an A or at least a B on each of these factors. Let's start with sex. It doesn't have to be the greatest in bed, but are you compatible? The biggest thing, that area of compatibility, is sex drive. Some people, that in the sexual area, is the amount of sex drive. Some people want sex every day, twice a day, three times a day, at least for the first year or so or longer. And there are others who, for whom once a month is fine. Neither is better or neither is worse, but you want to have a partner who has a similar amount of sex drive. In the old days, sex drive was inhibited by religion, by parental strictures, but we are living really in an era in which there aren't such strictures anymore. So if somebody is not wanting sex on a regular basis, yes, it can be the relationship, but very often it's simply a physiological difference in sex drive. So back, we're talking about my report card here, about my relationship report card. Sexual compatibility is very important. Of course, as or probably more important, is out-of-bed compatibility. Do you enjoy talking with each other? Do you respect each other's opinions? Very important. Do you even feel good being in that room with the person, even if you're not talking? I think it is extremely important for both parties to be contributing significantly to income. Why? Because, first of all, it's almost impossible for one income to afford a house unless you're, you know, living in rural Wyoming or something. It's really, and even rentals are terribly expensive. But also there's the power imbalance issue. Unless you are contributing some income, consciously or not, there is a power imbalance, and the person who's earning the more money tends to either A, abuse the power, or B, really resent that all of the burden for all the income and the expenses and the education and the doctor bills and the housing and the furniture and the vacations and the cars and the insurance and the taxes lies on one person. It really does generally require two incomes. Another element of high standards is, and it's really, really critical, is kindness. We all vary on every factor, and we include kindness. Some people are really sweet and kind. Other people are really, really tough and mean. In a relationship, the person's foundation, especially toward you, but in general, needs to be kind. That is the real glue that holds a relationship together. The next element on the relationship report card is no fatal flaws. Yes, there are people who are chronically depressed or in okay relationships. Yes, there are people who are spendaholics or gamblingaholics or alcoholics who are good in a relationship, but generally that really puts the odds against you. Try to find a partner who has none of those kind of fatal flaws. There are too many couples who fight, scream, divorce at length and with great pain. If one of them has one of these deep flaws, those people are not necessarily meant to be in a relationship. And finally, the final item on the relationship report card that I want to talk about is this ineffable thing called feeling. I mentioned it briefly earlier. Feeling like you want to be in, just even when you're in the same room with that person, you feel good. When that person calls on the phone, when you know it's them, it simply feels good. You can't put those into words. When that person comes in the room, feels good. That's kind of a one definition of love. So that's what's really important in a relationship. Have those high standards, because you are better off solo than in a so-so relationship. And that's, you know, that makes a certain assumption that I want to share here. So many people go into a relationship kind of anesthetized by the lust or the initial passion, infatuation. They say, oh, I can fix that. Oh, I can fix that. But even psychotherapists know that it's really, really hard to fix somebody. Maybe, yes, try to tweak yourself more than tweak the other person. Encourage the other person to tweak themselves in little areas. But the person who is phlegmatic isn't going to become outgoing. The person who's not that intelligent isn't going to become a brainiac. The person who is a kind of sloppy by nature isn't going to become a neat freak. Person who just loves materialism isn't going to suddenly become an ascetic monk. Basically, you have to accept the person for who they are, and if that person is not good enough as is, probably, again, better off solo than so-so. Tweaking, not fixing. Tweaking, yes. Fixing is too big. You're listening to How to Do Life. I'm Marty Nemko. When I come back, we'll talk money. We'll talk health, physical health, and we'll talk mental health.
You're listening to How to Do Life with Marty Nemko. You can email Dr. Marty Nemko with your comments and questions at mnemko@comcast.net. Or for his articles and books, visit martynemko.com. That's martynemko.com. Now back to How to Do Life.
Money. Couples fight all the time about money. People make enormous sacrifices for money. I want to talk about that first. My God, how many people do careers they dislike for money? Whether they be insurance salesmen or bond traders, or even doctors or lawyers. There are so many unhappy doctors, so many unhappy lawyers, so many unhappy accountants. They're prestigious and executives because the competition is so enormous, the stress is so great, that even if you're getting paid a great salary, if you come home exhausted and you're sitting in your nice house and you're unbuttoning your tie and drinking fancy wine, but you're exhausted and wondering, is that all there is? You're giving away the best year, the best hours of your day, the best years of your life to something you hate merely because it's got a big paycheck. And the irony is, the way our tax system works, and that's even before a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren or a Pete Buttigieg get elected, we are already paying, people who are making good money are already paying half in taxes, federal tax, income tax, state income tax, potentially local income tax, Social Security, workers' compensation, Medi-Cal tax, Medicare tax, on top of tolls, parking fees, usurious traffic fines, excise taxes on tires, user fees for supposedly public places. So when people sell out and spend their life in a job they don't like for money, you only keep at most half of it. Far better to live a non-materialistic lifestyle. Status, ironically, and you can quote me on this, status is the enemy of contentment. Ultimately, people are not happier living in 3,000 square feet in a Tony neighborhood rather than 1,000 square feet in a modest neighborhood. they're not happier driving a Beamer or a Jaguar or a Mercedes that paradoxically need more servicing and break down more often than the much less expensive Toyota or Subaru. You buy one of those that's 3 or 4 years old compared to buying these new Mercedeses, etc. And over your lifetime, you'll save hundreds of thousands of dollars and have more reliability. And if somebody doesn't like you because you're driving an older Toyota rather than a new Beamer, is that really somebody you want to sacrifice your work life for and work on some crappy job? And higher education. Some foolish people, and I'm going to establish some credibility. I have a PhD in evaluation of education from Berkeley. This is something I know about. I've written a lot on higher education, books and many, many articles. Your outcomes in college are minimally dependent on how much you spend on college. Of course, I think if you get into a Harvard or an MIT or a Caltech or a Stanford or a Princeton or Yale, it's probably worth the money, and they have a lot of money anyway. The college does, so they think they give generous financial aid. But most people don't have that as an option. Save the money. Even if your kid is really bright or you're really bright, the smart money is on starting at a community college, which is nearly free, and living at home with your parents, because a hell of a lot of 17, 18, and 19-year-olds are really not mature enough to go off on their own. And in the hothouse of the dorms, there's a lot of tendency, that synergistic effect of being away from home for the first time results in a lot of, let's just say, ill-advised behavior. Potentially drug addictions, pregnancies, and certainly not studying. And paradoxically, the teaching quality at community colleges on average is better than at the prestigious research universities, because universities get their prestige from research. You save money in those ways. Not too much on housing. Avoiding the prestige of new fancy car brand names. And starting out at a community college, then yeah, maybe afterwards then transferring to a more designer label school, which, by the way, you're more likely to get into a brand name school as a transfer, brand name college, than you were as a freshman. Really important. Now we're still on money. I want to talk about investing. Of course, I am not a licensed financial advisor. And anything that's very simple, what I'm going to spend a minute or two on this is going to be simplistic, but it's a hell of a place to start. And most excellent financial advisors will tell you that this is pretty standard, mainstream, good advice. Certainly have maybe a couple of months of savings for a rainy day, put in a money market fund or checking account. The rest, and we never know what the future is going to bring, but you're wisest to invest your money, either if you're very conservative, in a top-yielding bank CD, which you can find the highest rates in the country on bankrate.com, and you can get a bank CD anywhere in any state. You don't have to be in your state. But if you're going to take a little more risk for potentially far greater return, the good guy in the whole industry, and I swear nobody's paying me to say this, and I've said this so many times in writing and on radio and whatever, is Vanguard. They have by far the lowest fees, and they wisely recognize that index funds, and it's beyond the scope of this conversation to tell what an index fund is, except that it's, I'll just say, it's not an actively managed fund. It's like all the stocks in the S&P 500. It doesn't require a money manager to try to investigate the stocks. 85% of all active money managers, you know, this bombastic Bushkin who's going to try to pick which stocks are going to do better, do worse than that unmanaged index like the S&P 500. Because the price of all the stocks in the S&P 500 represent the collective wisdom of the billions of dollars that are being invested in that stock. No individual, no team of people can generally, year in and year out, be wiser than that. And because Vanguard is not spending a fortune on all these active money managers who are, you know, doing fancy calculations and visiting the companies and interviewing or whatever, their fees are really, really low. And the simplest approach that you could take to investing within Vanguard is to choose one of their all-in-one funds. And you can Google that. there are different, it has different flavors of all-in-one funds. Some are more heavily weighted toward stocks. Some are more heavily weighted toward bonds, which are less volatile, but have historically had a less lower rate of return. But the fee to invest in that is less than 0.25% per year. That's so much less than most others. And with, by investing in one of those, you're getting diversification. All your eggs are not in one basket. It automatically rebalances so that you don't get overweighted. You know, if so, you really only want 60% of your money in stocks and 40% in bonds, it will automatically, when it gets below that, rebalance so that you're keeping it at 60%. And they don't have high turnover, because every time you buy a stock and you sell it, you have to pay capital gains, which is taxes. Where, and in mutual funds, because these all-in-one funds don't turn over stocks very often, you're not going to pay much in taxes. It'll be all deferred, so that all of the growth in the stock will keep getting reinvested, and so it's getting reinvested tax-free. That's maybe more than is understandable to many folks, but certainly one could do infinitely worse than to invest in a Vanguard all-in-one fund. Remember, the Vanguard isn't going to run away with your money. I know so many people who invested in, you know, the Bernie Madoffs of the world, and there's a million of them, who, you know, who will promise you the moon. And they've got this scheme, they got this great idea. Yeah, I'm going to do this oil and gas lease thing, and I'm going to do this and this and this. You're safer, you're more likely to be able to sleep at night if you do invest in a company that's reputable like a Vanguard. Of course, there are others, they're not, all the others are not terrible, like Fidelity and Schwab. They're not going to run away with your money either, for sure. But the fees are much higher there. And so anyway, their representatives are not on commission. So if you go to Vanguard.com and you look at Vanguard all-in-one funds and you've got questions, which appropriately you'll have, you can call them and there'll be a person who's not on commission there to answer your questions. They're not there to give, they're not giving advice as to what you should invest in, but they will help clarify your thoughts. They'll answer your factual questions. And their website is really easy to use. It's because they are the largest holder of investment money in the world. So they can afford to spend the money to make their website really transparent. Okay, now I want to talk about donation. There's a tendency to give money to the least among us. But it's often, it's, as every medic triage knows, don't necessarily use your limited resources on those who are the sickest. Give to those with the greatest potential to profit. And so my example is, sure, my heart goes out to the poor people in Africa or the poor people in America who are really struggling, starving, but they have such a multiple constellation of problems, I don't believe my money is going to help. Nor is my money going to help where I'm donating to some big thing like American Cancer Society. My money is a drop in the bucket. But if there's an unmet need where there's high potential, and I'm going to give you my favorite two examples, that's where your money can make a difference. So I believe that blue-collar, intellectually gifted kids are an underserved community that can have huge potential. They're really bright, but they don't have rich parents who can do everything for them. But they're not so poor that they have a constellation of problems where my money isn't going to help. My other idea that I love is what I call Mentor Match, where I'm trying to do this through some national association where mentors and protégés get matched with each other. Because if there's change going to occur, it's less likely to occur in a classroom and more likely in one-on-one. And I want to fund the development of that. Now, we only have a few minutes left. I want to talk about physical health. Again, I'm not an MD. I'm not here to give medical advice. But I do teach in the medical school at the University of California, San Francisco. And something that nearly every doctor will agree is that the cliche is true. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, maybe 5 pounds of cure. It is really hard to cure heart disease, cancer, diabetes, all the rest. They can be managed, but it's tough to really cure them. And we know that the basics are your best way. Certainly your genes matter a lot, you know, for better or for worse. But certainly not being obese, not smoking, not abusing substances. And believe me, we all, of course, know alcohol is dangerous, but we are learning not just from advocates, but from the established research universities, that marijuana is far more dangerous than has been previously thought. Increased cardiovascular risk, that is risk of heart disease and strokes, even in young people. Risk of more mental illness, even schizophrenia. More so, it's risk of anxiety, depression. And anecdotally, certainly we all know people who are regular smokers of weed who have, quote, amotivational syndrome, or whose memory isn't as good. Those preventions, reasonable exercise, they say sitting is the new smoking. Get out of that chair every hour, or when your body feels itchy. For me, it's somewhere between 30 and 90 minutes. When I sit here all the time because I got clients all the time, or I'm writing, or I'm doing this. When my body's feeling itchy, I make myself get up, take the dog for a walk, clean the toilets, whatever. Those preventions, certainly if I didn't mention it, not smoking cigarettes, Jesus, cancer sticks, and cardiovascular disease sticks. But those preventions, if you can make your muster, if you can love yourself enough to avoid doing that stuff, you're going to be way ahead of the game. Now, I want to end with talking about mental health. I've seen more people who have had trauma in their life get worse, or certainly no better, and certainly stay narcissistic by revisiting it again and again and again, either with their friends or with a therapist or whatever. In general, the healthiest thing you can do is to stop revisiting. To say, I'm going to stay in the moment. I'm going to take my next baby step forward. What will help me take the next baby step forward? Because every time you think back, those memory neurons associated with the bad thoughts are going to be more strengthened and more top of mind, and you'll be more unhappy. Generally, any more processing after just a little bit of time is unlikely to help you move forward. Take the next baby step forward. Indeed. Stay in the moment in general. If you look too far ahead, the mountain ahead of you is so high you can be overwhelmed. You just want to sit and get high. Try to stay in the moment. Sure, a little planning is fine. But like right now, I've got a lot of stuff going on in my life. But all I'm thinking about is you and trying to be as helpful as I can to you. I want to end with my dad's story because my dad is the ultimate example of not looking back. I'll cut it short. He was a Holocaust survivor, escaped with, I think, 56 men, dumped in the Bronx without a penny to his name, no money, no English, no education, only the scars of the Holocaust tortures. And he ended up living a very, blue, originally worked in a factory sewing shirts, but eventually he saved up enough money for a tiny, tiny store. And one day, I asked him, I was about 12 or 13, and I said, Daddy, how come you so rarely talk about the Holocaust? And he stiffened, which is something he rarely did. And he said, Martin, the Nazis took 5 years from mein life. I won't give them 1 minute more. Martin, never look back. Always take the next step forward. And I've had the privilege of being career and personal advisor to 5,800 clients, including some of the most successful people on planet Earth, as well as some real strugglers. And one of the biggest differentiators, intelligence is probably most and drive is probably second, but also very important, the successful ones are far more likely to follow my father's advice. Never look back, always take the next step forward. I want to end the show as I end all of them by reminding you, I'm Marty Nemco, and we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
For comments on the show or to consult with Marty Nemco, his email address is mnemko@comcast.net. How to Do Life is produced by Marty Nemco. Post-production, Mel Baker. Music from the Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks for listening.